welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature the celebrated novelist and screenwriter Alice Hoffman. She's in conversation with the director of the Multnomah County Library, Vailey Elke, at Wordstock, Portland's book festival in 2016. Hoffman has published over 40 books, most of them novels, but also short story collections and books for young adults and children. Her work almost always contains a magical element, something she attributes to her childhood, in which she was a voracious reader of fairy tales. Hoffman was at Wordstock to discuss her book Faithful, which had just been published. She is perhaps best known for her novel The Dove Keepers, which Toni Morrison called, quote, a major contribution to 21st century literature. It is considered by many to be Hoffman's masterpiece. What I love about this conversation is you can hear and almost feel how Hoffman's life experience has been poured into this book about survivorship, misfits, and family bonds. There's a sense of tenderness for her characters, even when they are at their worst. At one point in the conversation, Hoffman says, "A book you love makes you feel like you are known." I cannot imagine a better way to sum up a love of reading. Here's Hoffman and Vailey Elke.
Hi.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I'm well. I understand you're going to do a little reading for us before we get started with our conversation.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm going to read a little bit from my new book, Faithful. You just need to know that it's about a girl named Shelby. She's been a very difficult daughter. She's now turning 21. And currently, she's living with someone named Ben Mink. And she's also been collecting dogs. So that's all you need to know about this. Sue Richmond is coming to visit, and there's no way to put it off. Shelby has kept her mother away from the apartment with a string of excuses for as long as she possibly can. She's afraid her mom will be shocked by her living conditions, but Sue won't take no for an answer this time. She wants to celebrate. The occasion is Shelby's 21st birthday, which Shelby would just as soon ignore. All this week, she's been preparing for her mom with a cleaning frenzy. But even after she's swept and mopped and attacked the bathroom with a vengeance, the apartment still looks terrible. "Your mother's coming to see you, not the apartment," Ben says. He wishes he could join them for lunch, but he works uptown in the school's clinic. He brushes Pablo's hair from his black slacks. He is not a fan of the Great Pyrenees. There's the shedding, the cost of food, the way Pablo sprawls across the couch. "Small apartments should have small dogs," was Ben's initial response when Shelby brought Pablo home. Their place is 300 square feet. There's hardly any space, so coats and boots are shoved under the bed. Pots and pans line the countertop, the washed with the unwashed, and a big garbage can filled with kibble takes up most of the hallway. When her mother arrives, Shelby buzzes her in. It's a cold March day, and Sue is out of breath by the time she gets up the fourth flight of stairs. "I guess you don't need to exercise when you have to climb all the way up here," Sue says, collapsing on the couch next to Pablo. Shelby notices that the couch is worn, with frayed threads on the arms. "This is a cute apartment," Sue says. "It's compact." "It's the size of a closet," Shelby says. "A closet would have shelves," Sue laughs, and Shelby does too. Her mother wants to see the best in everything and everyone. She's brought along two shopping bags full of presents. There are chocolates and a soft alpaca shawl and a new set of sheets. "I know you usually prefer black, but the green looks so springy." "It's definitely springy," Shelby says of the shawl. She already knows she will never wear it. "You're only 21 once," Sue says cheerfully. "It's a big day, and I think you've made this place very homey." Even though Shelby's fairly certain her mom has spied the mouse traps in the corners. Her dogs don't bother to go after the mice. They just watch them as though they were some form of entertainment. They go to a French restaurant on 9th Avenue, and they order beet salads and glasses of white wine, and they sit in uncomfortable rattan chairs, and Sue thinks the place is charming. "I'm so glad I get to take you out," Sue says. Shelby keeps her mouth shut. She doesn't want to be a downer, but all this birthday means to her is that she's lived 4 more years than Helene. "I can't believe you're a biology major," Sue says. "I always knew you could do anything you wanted." "It's not like I'm going to be a doctor or anything," Shelby says. But secretly, she has been thinking about vet school. It's stupid. She'd never be smart enough. All the same, she could do some good in the world. And I forgot to give you this, Sue says, pushing an envelope across the table. It's a birthday card with a photo of a basset hound. Inside, the message reads, "Have an arfing good birthday." Very funny, Shelby says. When she opens the card, she discovers five $100 bills. Mom, you don't need to do this. Your father sold the store, so I wanted you to share in the good luck. Dan Richmond has always said the store he inherited from his father could only be taken away over his dead body. Are you kidding me? He sold it? When was he going to tell me? It's going to be a Starbucks, Sue tells her cheerfully. They bought out his lease, and now your dad has a job at the Walt Whitman Mall. He's in the men's department at Macy's. Shelby is fairly certain that Walt Whitman has been turning over in his grave ever since the mall on Long Island was named for him. And Dad is okay with all of this, she asks. What about the family legacy and all that? Do you want to run a men's clothing store? No, Shelby says. Then take the money, Sue tells her. That's the legacy. So Shelby does. She leans over and kisses her mom. It will be good for emergencies, she says, like if I ever have to leave Ben. She said aloud what she's been thinking for a long time. They are not suited for each other. They're like strangers on a train, only they live in the same apartment and sleep together, but they don't know each other in any deep way. Sue studies her. Is there something wrong between you two? The tables are jammed together, ensuring that customers have no privacy, and there's an older couple sitting next to them who have suddenly stopped talking. Obviously, Shelby's conversation with her mother is more interesting than anything they have to say to each other. It's a what-if situation, Shelby says, like, what if I catch him having an affair? Your dad's having an affair, Sue says. What? Shelby's ears are ringing. She must have heard wrong. Their onion soups are delivered, so Sue doesn't speak until the waiter leaves them alone. The couple next to them are rapt. They don't say a word. It's someone at Macy's. She got him the job. How do you know this? Sue gives Shelby a look. You know these things, Shelby. Plus, Sheila Davis next door told me. She saw them walk out to the store and get into your dad's car and drive away. And anyway, it's nothing new. What is that supposed to mean? Sue shrugs. It's been going on, Shelby. He considers himself to be a ladies' man. I think it makes him feel better about himself. Do you think he wanted to run his father's store? What the hell did he want? He wanted to be a singer. Seriously? I thought he looked like Paul McCartney. Dad? Well, before he was bald, Sue says. Oh, and I forgot this. Sue opens her purse and she hands over a postcard. I'm forgetting everything today. Oh, great, my stalker. Shelby started to wonder why the person who sends her postcards has never come forward. Your angel, Sue says. This time I saw him. He drives a black car. I doubt he's an angel. He's probably some lunatic who read about me in the paper. On the postcard, there is a drawing of a woman wearing a blindfold. And the message is, see something. It is then that Shelby notices her mom's hand is shaking, just the way Shelby's hand tremors when she's anxious or upset. Shelby's been so busy feeling sorry for herself, she hasn't seen what her mom is going through. And now she reaches to take her hand. I'm sorry, Shelby says. Dad is a shit. We just got stuck in a marriage that is sadder than being alone. If you don't love someone, don't stay. I mean it, Shelby. Even if you need more than $500 to get your own place, even if you hurt Ben, what Shelby sees is that her mother loves her and that she's driven in to have onion soup that is not particularly good and that she's bold enough to ask the waitress if she can put a candle in the eclair that they share for dessert. No one else would sing happy birthday to Shelby in a restaurant on 9th Avenue or tell her that despite everything she's been led to believe, love is the only thing that matters.
That's very nice. So I love that you opened with that piece that focuses on that relationship between Shelby and her mother. You had mentioned in an interview in the Washington Post back in October, as it turned out, the deepest love in this book was between the mother and the daughter. And I didn't realize the book was going to be so much about that bond, which is really unique. Even if you have a terribly difficult daughter or problems with your mother, it's so timeless. That, for me, was the center of the book. And as I've reflected on this book, that relationship is what kept coming up for me, even though at times it didn't seem as central to the storyline. So I wondered if you'd speak a little bit to why you see that relationship as the center of the book.
I think it's true. As I was writing it, I didn't know that that was the center of the book.
Yeah.
I think what happens is, you know, Shelby is a, she has survivor's guilt, and, you know, I always feel that if one person believes in you, you can make it through, and for her, it's her mother. Yeah. And even though her mother's in the background a lot of the time, she still feels that her mother is there for her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I experienced the same thing. My mother was always there for me, and I was a terrible daughter. And, you know, she stood by me no matter what, which I think is kind of amazing. And also, like Shelby, I didn't appreciate my mother at all. In fact, I spent, I guess, half of my life being furious at her, and then the other half feeling really grateful to her for the same things that I was furious about.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think, so in that passage that you just read, there does seem to be a point where Shelby feels grateful. Do you think that that became more overt for her as the story progressed? I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, what happened towards the end and how Shelby engaged with her mother. I don't want to give anything away.
Right. Well, I think what happens is that she realizes that her mother's always been there for her, and she realizes that she's loved her no matter what.
Yeah.
And I think that gives you kind of an inner strength. When one person mm-hmm. believes in you, you feel like maybe there's some truth to that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe there's something worthwhile here inside me.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the other things you talked about in that article in the Washington Post last month was this notion of survivorship.
Yeah.
And I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about what about survivorship is so compelling to you, and what's resonant about that to you, and how did that inform Shelby's story?
Well, you know, again, this took me a long time to realize. I always think that readers are much smarter about books than the writer herself is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my writing comes from a very subconscious place, so mm-hmm. very often I don't understand it until after the book is finished, and sometimes years after the book is finished. I think I've always been writing about survivorship, and I think partially it's because of my grandmothers, who were a big influence on me. They were Russian immigrants. They survived a lot. And just the idea of women's stories and women who've survived trauma and how they've been able to survive and tell their own stories. Mm-hmm. I'm a breast cancer survivor of 18 years, so I think that's impacted it. But even before that, I think those were the stories that I was always interested in.
And do you see, it makes me think about where Shelby ended up at the end of the book. Do you see that sort of where she landed as, do you think she has a sense of having survived? Do you feel like, you know, based on sort of her experience responding to the relationship with her friend, the loss of her friend, all those relationships she went through, do you feel like she was cognizant of that at the end of the book?
I think so. I mean, Shelby, for people who haven't read it, just to not give anything away, but she has a terrible accident when she's a teenager, and her friend doesn't escape, and she does. Mm-hmm. And so she carries this tremendous burden with her. I think women tend to do that.
Yeah.
They turn things in onto themselves and blame themselves, and that's what she does. And until she can kind of break that and forgive herself, she really can't. She's stuck. She can't go on with her life.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes me think a lot about her tendency to rescue people, rescue especially dogs.
Yeah.
I thought of her the other day, actually, when I saw a little dog that was in a bad place. And I almost, inspired by Shelby,
stole the dog.
Almost. I was like, Shelby did it, I can do it. But so that sort of compulsion for her to rescue, do you think that's a part of her learning to forgive herself? Or what is it about that need to rescue that informs who Shelby is and informs the story?
Well, I always think that, you know, for me, at any rate, dogs have been the people I've always been closest to.
Yeah.
And I feel that, you know, in traumatic situations, you know, they always bring in dogs, you know, that dogs can, people who are traumatized and can't relate to other people can often relate to dogs.
Yeah.
And I also think the whole idea of being a rescuer changes your vision of who you are.
Yeah.
You know, you become less of a victim. You become the rescuer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, in a way, the book started in a lot of different ways, but one of the ways was in Boston, there were these people who used this cat and a dog, and they were on kind of a platform, and they traded them, you know, to use when they asked for money. It was better to have the cat and the dog. Yeah. And I thought, that cat and dog must have some story to tell, you know?
Yeah.
They just can't tell it.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was, I think that was a hard, for me at least, I'm a huge lover of dogs myself, and that was a hard thread to read in the book, you know, the notion of people using those animals.
I know, but I think what's so great is that this whole consciousness about adopting animals and getting animals out of these situations. Yeah. I know my dog is actually like a purebred crazy dog who I named Shelby after the character. Uh-huh. But my son has this incredible rescue dog, and I think rescue dogs are so grateful.
Yeah.
I mean, I know
yeah.
his is. I mean, the dog is so his dog is so amazing that when my son goes out, the dog goes in the closet and closes the door until my son comes home. You know, he's just like kind of
That's
waiting for him.
Dog.
Yeah, he's an amazing dog.
My dog doesn't do that. So as the book opens, Shelby, you know, as you've sort of reflected on, is going through a lot of pain and suffering mm-hmm. as a result of this accident. When you're writing a character who's racked by guilt and sorrow, how do you maintain emotional distance, or do you? And do you, you know, I've heard other writers talk about sort of inhabiting characters. Do you do that, or do you look at them sort of as your creation, who you can sort of like that dog, sort of put away in a closet for a bit of time and then come back to? What is that experience like for you?
No, if anything, I'm the dog in the closet, not them. I feel like, you know, they kind of come through me.
Yeah.
And, you know, then I do a lot of revisions, but in the first drafts, I feel like I don't control them. Even if I make an outline, even if I think I know what they're about, they become alive, and I feel that I'm kind of channeling them in a way. They're themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, but also, you know, of course, each character, it's like they say the characters in your dream, you're every character in
exactly,
your dream.
Exactly, which usually I don't care for.
I know, but I think it's kind of true. And I feel the same thing is true with novels. You know, the novelist is a little tiny bit of each of their characters, although I don't feel that I write autobiographically because I feel that I want to escape reality. I felt that as a reader. I feel it as a writer.
Huh.
But still, you know, Shelby and I have things in common anyway.
Yeah, so that leads to another question I had, which is, did you have any difficulty writing? Shelby is in your story. She's in her late teens. She's 20, 21. You and I are not 21.
Really? Wait a minute.
Did you find that challenging to write? I mean, you wrote very, very convincingly as a teenager and as a, you know, as a young woman. Was that difficult for you? How do you channel that? Is it just sort of surface?
I don't think it's difficult at all. In fact, it's a great relief not to be yourself.
Yeah.
And to, you know, it's almost the way I would imagine actors feel when they become someone else on stage and they inhabit another person.
Yeah.
You know, it's really someone else.
Yeah. So that makes me also think about, you know, a lot of your other books have had themes of sort of the mystical and fantastical, magical. And as you were just talking about, you know, writing books to escape reality, is there something about that writing, you know, in a sort of in another world that is about escaping reality?
Well, you know, for me, and I don't think this is a particularly magical book.
Mm-hmm.
I think
I agree, yeah.
You know, but I think for me, you know, when there's magic in my books, for me, it's because I think what you read, especially when you're young, is what informs you and what influences you the most as a person, as a reader, as a writer. And I grew up reading fairy tales and folk tales. So for me, magic and literature just go together. It's not like separate and I put them together. They are together.
Yeah.
And when I read something very realistic, I may love that book, but it doesn't feel like kind of the original organic literature that was the beginning of everything that I always think of as like a grandmother telling stories to her grandchild.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So a lot of your characters, I think, could be construed as sort of misfits, right? I mean, Shelby certainly fits that sort of general definition. There's this great TED Talk by a woman who's actually a local Portland writer, Lydia Yaknovich. The TED Talk's called The Beauty of Being a Misfit. And it describes a misfit as a person who literally missed fitting in and who experiences the shame of feeling something good or wanting something good. She talks of misfits as reinventing themselves from the ruins of their failures and of grief and loss that can make you insane, which I think sort of describes Shelby in some ways. Does that misfit mythology resonate with you? And if so, how does it help readers immerse themselves in the story? And is there an advantage to telling the story from the eyes of a of someone who might be considered a misfit?
Well, I think, you know, a misfit, I think everyone has felt that way at some point or other, has felt like, you know, alone or not fitting in, or there's something wrong with them. And I feel like, you know, when part of reading is not just to know the book, it's that when you find a book that you love, you feel like you're known.
Yeah.
And I remember reading Catcher in the Rye and having that feeling, you know, how does this writer know how I feel?
Yeah.
And I think it's that kind of connection. And I think I really believe that everybody feels that way at some point and can immediately tune into that feeling.
Yeah, no, I would completely agree. And I think that's often what resonates for people when they find, as you said, when they find a book that they really love. So I just want to break here and remind this audience and the radio audience that we're sitting here with Alice Hoffman discussing her new book, Faithful, in conversation as part of Wordstock in Portland, Oregon. So I have a fun question for you.
Okay.
Early in the story, as Shelby and Maribel's friendship is forming, Shelby notes that she's drawn to sad singer-songwriters, mm-hmm. which I can relate to. And she calls out the Decembrists,
yes.
a band many of us here know and love, and the Weepies.
Yes.
And the Weepies album, Say I Am You, seems like it could almost be a soundtrack to Shelby's life. The songs like World Spins Madly On and Citywide Rodeo, Riga Girls, and Nobody Knows Me At All, which I actually was thinking of that song as you were just talking about the fact that you're less lonely when somebody knows you.
Yeah.
Does music inform your life and your writing?
It does, and actually I'm friends with Deb Talon,
who's one of the Weepies,
who's a breast cancer survivor, an amazing person, an amazing artist. I love her work, and I think music does influence me, and I feel like, you know, this is what I always think with my character, you know, what music would they listen to? Yeah. Where would they go to eat? You know, what movies do they love? You know, I feel like it forms them, and that's part of kind of like the soundtrack of our life in a way.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. So getting back to that earlier conversation about magic and it just being sort of part of literature, I was thinking about the stalker, as it were, and that in some ways it's almost he is almost characterized as sort of this sort of guiding spirit, right, for Shelby, and a touchstone for her over the course of the story. And I'm wondering if you think that Shelby would have been able to save herself without that sort of touchstone or that guide or that something out there that seemed to see her, you know, as you've talked about.
Well, you know, possibly, but I think it certainly helps to feel connected.
Yeah.
And even though this person is invisible to her and doesn't make himself known, she knows that someone out there knows she's alive and knows what she's going through. And I think that's really major. In a way, it's the same thing as reading. You know, I feel like the postcards that she gets are almost as if she's reading a book every time she gets the postcards.
Yeah.
And part of their initial argument that they have with each other when they meet each other is about, is life like a novel or is life like a book of short stories?
Yeah.
And I think it's an interesting argument. I have that argument with myself all the time. And I kind of think it's more like a book of interrelated short stories.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, I've had a similar sort of conversation. Have you written short stories?
Yeah, I have.
And do you have a preferred medium?
Well, you know, I don't have a preferred medium, but I think I was very influenced by Ray Bradbury, and the book that they are talking about in Faithful is The Illustrated Man, and that when I read that book, it was very mind-blowing because I'd never read interconnected stories before. That was my first time.
Yeah.
So I think that can be really powerful.
Could you imagine Shelby's story being like a series of short stories?
I think it could be.
Yeah.
You know, I think you know, in a way, it's short stories and a novel. It's like linked together, but she has different kind of episodes in her life.
Yeah, that sort of connect
as it
goes along. And do you think that Shelby, by the time she gets to, because she's really sort of redeemed at the end of the story, I think, is that notion of not just rescue and saving herself, but also of redemption. And would you say that, you know, everybody wants to know what happens to Shelby? I want to know what happens to Shelby next, right? So I'm not going to ask you if you're going to write more about Shelby, but do you feel as though Shelby's future is is in a good place.
Yeah, I feel really good about her. The funny thing for me is that, you know, in writing about her, I don't have a daughter, and that's a big sorrow in my life. So I almost felt that she was my daughter, and I was very angry at her through half of the book, which maybe that's what happens between mothers and daughters. And I felt really proud that she managed to get through this, because I think it's just very hard to get through a trauma like that as a whole person and be able to move forward. And I felt like at the end she was able to do that.
And I'm wondering, you know, her experience with the loss of her friend, and then her, you know, that sort of constant reminder of her friend living nearby and the people who visited her, if Shelby could have moved away. You know, I mean, I feel like that was such a backdrop to her story. And in some ways, to me, I think I would have wanted to just get the hell out of there.
Right.
And I wonder why she stayed. She sort of left, right, with Ben and left for the city. But why linger?
Well, you know, I think I don't think I'm giving anything away by this, but at one point she wants to have her friend's name tattooed on her.
Yeah.
And the person who is the tattoo artist says to her, that's not your story.
Yeah.
So I think that's what she's learning through the book. Yeah. That's not her story. You know, terrible things happen to us, but it doesn't have to. Actually, it happened to me when I had cancer, and I was talking to my doctor and thinking about would I ever be able to write again. And she said to me, you know, cancer is not your whole story. It's just one piece of it. And I think that's a hard thing to learn when you're going through something like that.
And why the car accident? Like, how did you conceive of that as sort of the source of Shelby's sorrow and that loss? Why that event?
I have to say, I didn't make that happen. It just happened. But I think it's kind of, look, it's like, you know, terrible things happen out of the blue. And I think it's, you know, a car accident is emblematic of that. You know, it just happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, it happens while you're, you know, having a conversation, listening to music, whatever. And then all of a sudden, the whole world is upside down.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that was interesting, and you sort of referenced this a minute ago, was that there's this awful event. It's so traumatic, and it produces such grief and sorrow for Shelby, but also for Helene's family and obviously the rest of the community. But for Shelby, I might argue, there's almost a beauty that results because of that. But it's not because of the accident, right?
No, but I think the thing is, if you can get through a trauma, I think you come out a changed person.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's what happens to her. And, you know, when I was going through treatment, I read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which I think is such a brilliant book. Yeah. And it's really about, it's such a great book. He lost everyone in his family in concentration camps. And was a psychiatrist, and was trying to make meaning, like, what does this all mean? Why do people go through horrible things? Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, his theory was, you know, that we become the people that we are because of the tragedies that we experience. Yeah. And it's true.
Yeah.
And it happens to everyone, you know, sooner or later, and it's just kind of how you respond to it and how you go on with your life.
So, but don't wish for tragedy, right?
Oh, God, no. You don't have to wish for it.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me ask you sort of the perennial question that writers always get. Can you talk to us a little bit about, I mean, you've talked about things just sort of emerge and come to you. Do you have a discipline around writing?
Yes. Yeah,
what does that
I
look
do.
Like?
Well, you know, the books come from different places. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes they start with a character, sometimes they start with a situation. For instance, when I wrote The Dove Keepers, which takes place in first century in Israel, and that happened because my son is an archaeologist and kind of led me to these archaeological digs, and I went to visit Masada, which is this mountaintop, many of you know, where 900 Jews held out against the Roman army for 3 years, and I had no, you know, interest in it other than, you know, being in awe of being there, but then I saw a plaque that said there had been survivors. Yeah. And at the minute I saw that, I thought, this is a novel for me.
Yeah.
So usually, you know, I take notes, I have outlines, I have big poster boards, I do a lot of research. But when I start writing, that kind of all goes out the window and I just write.
And does it change? Do you have a sense of where it's going to end, or does that just sort of evolve and manifest over time?
Well, sometimes I know, and sometimes I write the ending, and sometimes it stays the ending, and sometimes it changes completely. So, for instance, with the Dove, just to mention the Dove Keepers again, I knew that I was writing in the voices of four women, and I know that only two women survived, but until the very end, I had no idea which two women that was going to
really?
Be.
Really?
Yeah.
Till the very end?
Till the end.
And what turned? What?
It happened.
Yeah. I think I'm going to start writing, and I'm going to use your technique. So, do you have of all the books you've written, is there one with which that process came easier than others?
You know, it never comes easy to me because every time I start to write a novel, I feel like I don't know how to write a novel. Huh. I don't know who that person was who
really?
Wrote those novels.
I think some folks here might disagree. But, yeah.
And I feel like I have to relearn how to write a novel, and it is not easy for me.
Yeah. And how old were you when you started writing?
Well, I was a secret writer as a child, and then I wrote when I went to college, and then I didn't, you know, I wanted to stay in school rather than get a job because I had worked all through high school and college, and I knew school was easier somewhat so my brother was living in California, and he said, there's a great school out here, you should apply to it. And there was a master's program in creative writing, so I applied, and it was Stanford, and they accepted me and gave me a fellowship. And
Stanford, you got a fellowship.
I had, I really had never heard of it before, that's where I came from.
Wow, yeah.
So it was lucky.
Yeah. So really, you'd not heard of Stanford?
No. I came from a place where no one knew what Stanford was.
So I was going to ask, so in your family, did people, how did you line up in terms of people going on to college? And?
Well, my mother was, you know, had books and was college educated, but in our neighborhood, that was a rarity. My brother was, you know, was very smart. He applied to a school we never heard of, and he went to it. It was Brown. We thought, what kind of school is called Brown?
Yeah, that's kind of boring.
So, you know, it just wasn't like in our world. If you went to City College or NYU, we lived in New York, we knew about that. But beyond that, it was kind of a closed world.
An option. And when you went away to Stanford, did you and got into the writing program, got a fellowship. At that point, did you imagine yourself a writer?
No, I never imagined myself a writer.
Yeah.
I imagined myself a reader. Huh. And what happened is that I had a great teacher, a great professor, and he completely changed my life. He was my teacher for 30 years. I sent him everything up until, you know, basically the day he died. He changed my life, and he sent a story of mine to a friend of his in New York who published it in a little magazine, and I got a letter a few weeks after it was published from a very famous editor saying, do you have a novel? And I wrote back saying, yes, I do. And I wrote really fast for 6 months. Oh, I think that's why I'm a fast writer now. Because I thought, no one's ever going to ask me this again. So, and then he worked with me for about a year. And then he ultimately didn't take the book, but he sent me to my agent, who was my agent for, you know, for a lifetime.
Forever.
Yeah.
And but you still don't imagine yourself a writer, is that what you're saying?
You know, it took me about 20 years before I told anyone I was a writer.
Really?
Yeah, now I feel like, okay.
That's good.
I think that's what I am.
Writing. Yeah.
Thank you.
So, are you working on another book?
Yeah. I'm always working.
As a writer?
I'm working on, this has been really fun for me, I'm doing a prequel to a book I wrote called Practical Magic.
Uh-huh. Yeah, good.
And that book has a lot of fans, and there's a movie that's really a cult movie that a lot of people love. And I thought, you know, I wasn't done with it. Yeah. And I wanted to go back in time, not forward. So I'm writing about the ants in the 1960s in New York City, and it's been really fun. I'm just finishing up.
And can you talk a little bit about the process, like, the experience of having a book turned into a movie? Did you expect that to happen? Was that something?
Well, I was a screenwriter for 25 years, to support my novels.
Right.
Yep. So I knew what happened to books, and I know that the book and the movie are not the same thing.
Yeah.
And I feel lucky that there were wonderful actresses in that movie, and they were fabulous. So, you know, I think they're two different things. And
and that's your experience of them. Yeah, and do you see anything else becoming a movie?
I'm hoping Faithful will be.
Yeah, I think that's probably a reasonable candidate for that. So I think we're going to take some questions from the audience. There's one. We have one down here. Some of you probably are old enough to remember Phil Donahue. That's what this feels like.
I'm not sure if you want to answer this, but I would love to know who your teacher was that made such a difference in your life.
My teacher? His name was Albert Gerard, And he was a professor at Harvard for 20 years and a professor at Stanford for 20 years. So many writers kind of were in his classroom, from John Updike, mm-hmm. John Hawkes. I mean, he had amazing influence on a whole generation, maybe three generations of writers. And he was incredibly generous. And that's why I realized that when I needed to, you know, have another job to support my novels, I really couldn't be a teacher, because I really feel like you give so much as a teacher that you often don't have time for your own writing. So the really strange thing is that I, after all this time, I just moved, and I found out after I moved that I moved into his house.
Oh, wow.
So I'm now living in his house, which is like, feels great to me. And I'm writing where he used to write his first novels. So wow. It was a nice end for me.
That's
to
wonderful.
That story. Yeah.
Yeah, that's terrific. That's a great story. Who else? I think there was a question right here.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for many, many happy hours. I absolutely adore everything you've written.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But it seems to me that all the years I've been reading you, there is a consistent theme of feminism in your books. Maybe not classically feminist characters, but they all find their strength. When you were in college, did you consider yourself a feminist?
Well, I consider every woman to be a feminist, whether they know it or not. I did, and especially because I remember when I went to Stanford, and I was not a very educated person, even though I'd gone to a small college. We had a anthology, and there were two women in it, and one was Grace Paley, who I really loved mm-hmm. and really kind of modeled myself after when I was starting to write. But I mean, we really didn't read many women. And I felt like very much it was like an uphill battle. I still think it really is, even though there's so many women in the novel buying population, I still think it's tough for women. And I definitely consider myself a feminist. I mean, I grew up in a household of women, and you know, my mother worked, my grandmother worked at a time when I didn't know anybody else whose mothers worked. And yeah, I do. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Have you read that Adichie book, Everyone Should Be a Feminist?
I love that book.
Yeah,
in fact,
book.
I bought five copies of it to give to friends.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful book.
It is a
book.
Wonderful book.
Oh, yeah.
Another question from the audience.
It's actually two questions. One, which of all of the books that you've written resonate most with you? Which one did you like the best creating and connected most with the characters in it? And then also for all the writers in the room, like what's like one kernel of advice you'd like to share?
Okay. You know what, I really believe in like writing programs and being with other writers. I mean, that first of all, I believe in. I believe in MFA programs or in taking courses. In Boston, we have something called Grub Street, which is this huge network of writers with classes and people you can work on your novel with. I'm sure there are things here. And I think that's really important to be with other writers. I think you have to be careful who you listen to about your work, because everyone's going to tell you something else, and you have to kind of choose who your critics are going to be. But I just think it's really important. The other thing is, it's really important to write and keep writing. And what I try to do is write X amount without reading it, so that I don't just throw it away really quickly. So I think it's so easy just to think, this is horrible, I'm throwing this away. I think if you just, you know, get up every day and write, I think, fast. If you write fast, you'll eventually write your way into the story. The first part of the question was favorite. You know, for me, of my own books, I think it was a book called Green Angel, because I didn't believe in writer's block until I got it. And I got it after 9/11. I couldn't write. And luckily, I went back and I read Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, which is a great book. Mm-hmm. It's about a society where books are outlawed, and they're so important to some people that those people become the book. They memorize the book. And it really reminded me of how important it is to tell stories, even in times when it seems that the whole world is falling apart, like it does now for many people, that it's really important to tell your own stories.
So
thank
that
you.
Kind of begs the question, do you have a favorite book by another author?
Oh, well, Toni Morrison is by far my favorite author. I think she's the greatest living writer. I just got to see her. She was just at Harvard giving a series of lectures. I saw her give three lectures, and I was just blown away. And I would have to say Beloved is my favorite
book.
My other favorite book always is Wuthering Heights.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. I love Wuthering Heights because I feel like it's, I think this makes a great book, that you can read Wuthering Heights when you're 16 and you think Heathcliff is like the most romantic guy in the world, right? Yeah. Then you read it when you're 30 and you think Heathcliff is a maniac.
Total maniac, exactly.
Then you read it when you're a little older and you think Heathcliff is very complicated.
He's complex. Yes, very
He's complex.
Complex.
And I just have to say this, that I was asked to give a talk about first love with a bunch of other writers in Washington, D.C. a few years back, and I talked about Heathcliff, and sitting right in the first row was Hillary Clinton, and she was nodding her head the whole time because she really got the Heathcliff thing.
Not a surprise.
Don't blame her for Heathcliff.
Okay, do we have other audience questions? Any upstairs?
Red Garden is my favorite book of all time.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to know how you came up with that structure. It's just such a wonderful jewel of a book.
You know, that story I didn't write consecutively. So I wrote different parts of it at different times, and then I kind of laid out the world, and kind of built the world around the couple of stories that I wrote, and I think I wrote the beginning of it at the end.
Yeah.
So it was really fun for me to write, and thank you. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Other questions?
Oh. So I think my first book I read of yours was White Horses, and that when you talked about that magic in the and literature go together, and I was so taken by the magic part because that was the first that I experienced it, and it was very powerful. But I wonder if you could speak some more about what that magic in literature is for you.
Well, you know, for me, the magic, especially as a child reader, very often when I read children's books, I felt that they were false. But when I read fairy tales, I felt that they were true. They were psychologically true in a way that I don't even think I understood. I just got it, you know. The whole idea of being lost in the woods, about having to find your way, about, you know, the whole kind of journey, psychological journey, really, from childhood to adulthood and all the dangers that lurk out there. I felt like fairy tales were the most honest things I read. So I love the idea about a matter-of-fact tone talking about fabulous things and amazing, miraculous things. I think that's really what influenced me and kind of started me writing about magic. And then as a child reader, that's what I read. I read anything with magic because it did seem, it was escapist in some ways, and yet it felt like it got to the truth in some deep way.
Was there a fairy tale that you reread? Was there one that particularly caught you?
There wasn't one particular one. It was more kind of the whole body of them, you know, the world of the world of fairy tales.
Yeah. I always found them really scary.
They are scary. Yeah. And some people say that you shouldn't read them to children under 8 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, they're scary.
Yeah.
They're raw. They're brutal. You know, terrible things happen.
Yeah.
When you're in the woods.
Gosh. No more hiking. Right in front here.
What do you think is your core belief or whatever that guides you?
Well, you know, that's a hard one because it faithful, I think, is about faith in many different ways. You know, faith in yourself, Shelby's mother's faith in her. There's a lot of different, you know, the dogs, the idea of being faithful and loyal. I think for me, I'm always searching. And for me, books usually start with questions, you know, that I want answered. You know, I think I'm always looking for how do you have faith in this world? I don't have the answer, so I have to write another book and another book. But I think I'm a searcher for how do you have faith in the world. Thank you.
Yeah, that was a great question. Right here.
I read and enjoyed The Museum of Extraordinary Things, and
I think
one of the things I really liked about it is it had some elements that I liked from Catherine Dunn's Geek Love. Was that an influence at all?
From
Geek Love by Catherine Dunn?
Catherine Dunn?
No, I haven't read Geek Love, but I know that it's a huge, cult, wonderful book, and I know that the author recently passed away, but I hadn't read it. But thank you. I appreciate it. That book was really fun to write. I'm in love with New York City, and it was kind of like a love song to New York City. It takes place in 1911, during the time when the Triangle Factory fire happened, which was the biggest workplace disaster until 9/11 happened, and it was mostly young Jewish women and girls who were locked into the factory to work and couldn't escape. And after that, you know, there were lots of different changes in in laws about and union activity. And it turned out that my grandfather was a member of the ladies' garment workers' union. What? So it was kind of personal for me also.
Yeah. Oh, way up there, way up there.
Hi.
Hi.
So you said that every time you start a project, you feel like you have to start relearning to write a book again, or that it's different each time. Do you have any tricks that kind of keep you from feeling completely dismayed when that happens?
No, I get hysterical. No, I mean, I keep forcing myself to write, even though it's really painful when I'm feeling that way. And it can happen, you know, half of the book can feel that way to me. And then eventually, if I keep going, I either stop writing that book because it's not working, or something happens and it clicks in and it becomes alive. So I think it's just, you know, you keep writing and you just keep doing it and doing it, and suddenly it feels like a book. I don't know how that happens. But thank you. Good question.
So there's one back in the very back behind you.
Marriage of Opposites. I wonder, did you start with the artist, Camille Pissarro, and then find his mother and her life? Or did you start with the mother and then create the rest of the book from that?
Well, The Marriage of Opposites, thank you. The Marriage of Opposites is about Camille Pissarro and his mother, Rachel Pissarro. And the way it started was I didn't have any particular interest in him, but I went to a show of his at Williams College, and I didn't know that he was Jewish, and I didn't know that he had grown up on St. Thomas. I thought of him as a French, the father of Impressionism. And then I started reading about him, and I read that his mother, Rachel, had caused the biggest scandal that had ever happened in St. Thomas. Immediately, I became much more interested in her than in him.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of how it happened.
Right here.
So what type of religious background was your household based on? Because so many of your books have the themes of Judaism in them, and yet they also are universal. So what was your life like growing up religiously?
Religiously, you know, I think I was from, my parents were from the generation of, you know, being very modern. They weren't religious, but they, you know, it was part of our life. I mean, I think it's part of life in New York City, actually. So it was a big part of our life, not about the religion part, but more the cultural part of it. Also, my grandmothers were like major in my life. So, you know, for me, I felt very connected to being Jewish because of my grandmothers and the stories that they told. I think I didn't really start writing about it until later on. I first wrote a book for teens called Incantation, which was about the Spanish Inquisition. And I mostly wrote that because I had a question, because I felt like I knew nothing about the Spanish Inquisition. I knew that, you know, my kids had never learned about it in school, and I just started reading about it. I mean, mostly I start, you know, a book with a question, and I don't know anything, and I have to learn something in the writing of the book.
I want to thank Alice for
thank
joining
you.
Us today and braving your way through our lovely weather here in Portland, Oregon. Can we please thank Alice for coming today?
Thank you. And thank you.
Oh,
thank you. Thank you.
That was Alice Hoffman in conversation with Vailey Elke at Wordstock, Portland's Book Festival in 2016. The Wordstock 2017 lineup has just been announced. The festival will take place on November 11th in downtown Portland. For more information about the author lineup, schedule, and tickets, visit literary-arts.org. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.